Chapter 28, Divine Misdirection. We're at a significant stage in the epic saga of God's goal for humanity, his desire to have a human family with whom he and his divine family could rule in a new Eden. Ever since the disruption of Eden, God has been at work to use men and women to restore the original vision. The most visible manifestation of that effort was the creation of a new family through Abraham and Sarah, Israel. But Israel failed miserably in its mission, from the incomplete conquest to the splintering of the unity of its 12 tribes to the collapse of the Davidic dynasty into exile in Babylon, the very place at which Yahweh had decided to disinherit the nations and create his own people millennia earlier. The apostasy of his people and their subsequent exile prompted a change in Yahweh's approach to restoring his rule on earth. He could not depend on humans, though he had pledged himself to humanity's preservation. He would no more forego the role of his human imagers than he would destroy them. Because his original creation of humanity, as his image, had meant free will agency, his kingdom must of necessity include humanity in its recovery and in rulership, else the Edenic vision would be undermined. There could be only one solution, though it would have two strategic deployments. God understood that only he could be trusted with perfectly accomplishing his own will. He would therefore have to become man, and in addition, he would have to inhabit the hearts of his children. Residing in a tabernacle or temple was not enough. He had to indwell those who chose to follow him. The second of these strategies is the most transparent. Through the prophet Jeremiah, God announced in the days before the southern kingdom of Judah fell to Babylon that though the kingdom of Judah would be destroyed, he was making a new covenant with his people. Jeremiah 31:33. I will put my law in their inward parts, and on their hearts I will write it, and I will be to them God, and they themselves will be to me people. Yahweh would send his spirit to indwell his people. They could not be trusted with their freedom, but he would not eradicate it, nor would he leave them without enablement. The first strategy, however, is much more cryptic. It will occupy our attention the rest of the chapter. This is not the Messiah you're looking for. Readers will instinctively realize that by this first strategy of God becoming a man, I'm ultimately referring to Old Testament prophecies about Messiah. Thoughts of Jesus naturally flow through our minds, but that's because we have the New Testament. We have 20/20 hindsight. Israelites and Jews in exile had no such thing. But the disconnection is much deeper than that. By God's design, the scripture presents the Messiah in terms of a mosaic profile that can only be discerned after the pieces are assembled. Paul tells us why in 1 Corinthians 2, 6-8. If the plan of God for the Messiah's mission had been clear, the powers of darkness would never have killed Jesus. They would have known that his death and resurrection were the key to reclaiming the nations forever. Chances are good that you've heard the New Testament mistakenly read back into the old hundreds of times. Therefore, you might be surprised to hear me say that the Old Testament profile of the Messiah was deliberately veiled. Let me illustrate. The word translated Messiah, Mashiach, is fairly common in the Old Testament. It occurs over 36 times. It simply means anointed. Lots of people were anointed in the Old Testament, particularly kings, but many of those were unscrupulous or incompetent or both. Mashiach occurs with reference to a deliverer whose appearance would be future to the Old Testament era in only a handful of places. And some of those aren't clear as to whether the anointed is even a follower of Yahweh. And there is no Old Testament verse that has a dying and rising Messiah, Mashiach. If you're thinking Isaiah 53 is the exception, it isn't. The word Mashiach does not appear in that passage. That doesn't mean Isaiah 53 isn't part of the messianic profile. It means that the content of Isaiah 53 is just one piece of a much larger whole. The pieces were kept separate to obscure the big picture. This sheds light on certain episodes in the New Testament, such as why Peter couldn't grasp the notion of Jesus going up to Jerusalem to die. Peter believed Jesus was the Messiah. The word for anointed one in Greek is Christos, Christ. When Jesus announced he was going to die in Jerusalem, Peter didn't say, "I know, I read that in my Bible." He couldn't read it in his Bible because there was no single verse for the idea. Rather, the concept of a dying and rising Messiah must be pieced together from a scattering of disparate fragments in the Old Testament that, each taken alone, don't seem to have anything like Messiah in mind. None of the fragments reveal the final assemblage. Even after the resurrection, the disciples had to have their minds supernaturally opened to see a suffering Messiah. The risen Jesus says that explicitly in Luke 24. "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything that was written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and Psalms must be fulfilled." Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures. The point is straightforward. Only someone who knew the outcome of the puzzle, who knew how all the elements of the messianic mosaic would come together, could make sense of the pieces. Jesus had to enable the disciples to understand what the Old Testament was simultaneously hiding and revealing. It wasn't a matter of reading a verse here and there. Unfortunately, most Christians today don't understand the complexity that Luke 24, 44, and 45 reveals. Instead, they repeatedly hear the New Testament read back into the Old. That's unfortunate, since this makes the Old Testament passages say things that no New Testament writer ever quoted them as saying. Genesis 3:15 is a good example. This is a passage where God told the serpent, Nahash, that one of his offspring would bruise the heel of one of Eve's offspring, and that Eve's offspring would bruise his, the serpent's, head. This is often taken as evidence for a suffering and dying Messiah, and the Messiah's victory over the forces of evil through the resurrection. But that isn't how the New Testament cites the passage. The verse is indeed alluded to by Paul in Romans 16:20, where he mentions the prospect of the serpent being crushed, not just his head, and not just bruised, but the crushing isn't performed by Jesus, the son of Eve and risen Messiah. Rather, Paul has God crushing the serpent under the feet of believers. The account of Abraham's near offering of Isaac, Genesis 22, is another example. Not only does no New Testament author ever cite the story as a picture of either the crucifixion or resurrection, but Isaac didn't die in the incident. Some see an allusion to this passage at Jesus' baptism, when a voice from heaven announced, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." But that isn't what the voice said in Genesis 22. See Matthew 3:17, Mark 1:11, Luke 3:22. These Old Testament passages and others have been made by modern commentators to speak about the Messiah and his work in ways the New Testament authors don't claim. We shouldn't create connections where the biblical text doesn't. Instead, we need to think more carefully about what we do find in the text. God's plan to redeem humanity, reclaim the nations, and revive Eden depended on the incarnation of the second Yahweh figure and his subsequent death and resurrection. The story of the cross is the biblical theological catalyst to God's plan for regaining all that was lost in Eden. It couldn't be emblazoned across the Old Testament in transparent statements. It had to be expressed in sophisticated and cryptic ways to ensure that the powers of darkness would be misled. And it was. Even the angels didn't know the plan. 1 Peter 1:12. Hidden in plain sight. I want now to give you a glimpse of God's secret plan for the hope of Israel and the disinherited nations. In biblical theology, all humanity. We'll focus on simple but fundamental pieces of the messianic mosaic that form meaningful patterns of thought. Let's begin with Adam. The obvious description of his role and identity is the first man. But look at Adam a bit more closely. If I ask, how is Adam cast in the biblical story? Some other ways of thinking about Adam present themselves. Adam was a son of God. As a son of the king, God, he was royalty. He was his father's designated ruler in Eden. He was also put in the garden to work the land, Genesis 2:15. One Hebrew lemma for his activity is avad, consonants, BD. Once expelled from the garden, he was displaced from God's kingdom to suffer. Working the garden became a difficult drudgery. But that isn't all. Adam lost his earthly immortality. He died. But scripture is careful to note via the genealogies that his lineage lived on. Most precariously, though, Noah all the way to Abraham, and then Israel, and finally to Jesus. His eternal life is guaranteed by God's power, but his bodily return to the new Eden depends on the resurrection of Christ, the firstborn from the dead. Colossians 1:18 and Revelations 1:5. We could summarize Adam's profile this way. Adam, son of God. Adam, ruler king, governs in God's place. Adam, servant. Adam suffers the effect of sin. Adam, exile and death, ceases to exist on earth. Adam lives on through descendants, resurrection contingent. Now let's think about Israel in terms of descent. Israelites trace their heritage back to Adam, but a closer examination of the story of the nation produces remarkable similarities to Adam's profile. God calls the nation his son in Exodus 4:23 and Hosea 11:1. Israel is not only the light to the nations, Isaiah 42:6 and 49:6, but God intended Israel to rule over the nations, Deuteronomy 15:6, 26:19, 28:1, and Romans 4:13. This only makes sense given that God is ruler of the nations, Psalm 22:28, and Israel is his son. This vision, of course, will be tied to the messianic era of David, Zechariah 9:9-10, and Psalm 89:27. Israel, corporally, is referred to as God's servant. Ibad lema bid, Isaiah 41:8-9, 44:1-2, 21:45:4, and 49:3. Like Adam, Israel's transgressions led to exile from the place where the divine presence resided, Isaiah 2:6-8, Ezekiel 7-9. Jeremiah 13:10. The result is suffering many times over. Under foreign powers and wicked kings, eventually Israel is exiled and ceases to exist as a nation. But the prophets foretold Israel's resurrection, most vividly through the vision of the dry bones, Ezekiel 37. The nation is reborn after the exile in the form of the returning inhabitants of Judah from Babylon. Israel's profile looks familiar. Adam, son of God. Israel, son of God. Adam, ruler king, governs in God's place. Israel, highest among nation. Israel's king is most high. Adam, servant. Israel, servant. Adam suffers the effects of sin. Israel suffers the effects of sin. Adam, exile and death, ceases to exist on earth. Israel, exile and death, ceases to exist on earth. Adam lives on with God and through descendants, resurrection contingent. Israel lives on through Judah, resurrection contingent. Next, Moses. As a believing Israelite, Moses was a son of Abraham and therefore of God. Romans 4, 11, 12, and 16. Galatians 3, 7, and 23 through 29. His status in that regard was special since he was God's appointed deliverer, ruler of the nation. Curiously, Yahweh tells him that he will be as God, a God, Elohim, to Pharaoh, and to Moses' brother Aaron, Exodus 4, 16, and 7, 1. It would be through Moses, of course, that God's signs and wonders would be wielded against Egypt. As a leader through whom flowed divine power, he would naturally come to be seen by the Israelites as a quasi-divine figure, though he was just a man. Moses is called the servant of God, Ebed Lema, Exodus 14, 31, Numbers 12, 7, Deuteronomy 34, 5, and Joshua 31. He suffers for his sin and is prohibited from entering the promised land, Numbers 20, 1 through 12, Deuteronomy 1, 37, and 34, verses 4 through 6. Though God permits him to see it from a distance before his death, in 34, 4 through 6. The Transfiguration, Matthew 17, 1 through 4, informs us that Moses lived on with God, but as with everyone, his resurrection in a new Eden was contingent on one who was to come. We can now add Moses to our table. Adam, son of God. Israel, son of God. Moses, son of God. Adam, ruler king, governs in God's place. Israel, highest among nations, Israel's king is most high. Moses, ruler king, over God's people. Adam, servant, Israel, servant, Moses, servant. Adam, suffers, Israel, suffers, Moses, suffers, all effect of sin. Adam, exile and death ceases to exist on earth. Israel, exile and death ceases to exist on earth. Moses, exile and death ceases to exist on earth. Adam lives on with God and through descendants, resurrection contingent. Israel lives on through Judah, resurrection contingent. Moses lives on with God, resurrection contingent. We now come to Israel's king. Recall that God had promised David an everlasting dynastic succession in what we now call the Davidic Covenant, 2 Samuel 7 and Psalm 89. The fulfillment of this promise would fail in the Old Testament era due to the death of Israel in exile. But Israel's resurrection through Judah, the tribe of David, would keep the promise alive, as we'll see in more detail later. The fulfillment of the promise would be inaugurated at the first coming of Jesus, Yahweh incarnate. The consummation of the promise is yet future. For our purposes here, how do the patterns emerge in Israelite Davidic kingship and the Messianic son of David? Like Moses and all believing Israelites, David was an earthly son of Yahweh. But we learn from certain Psalms that the kings of David's line were also called sons of God. In an act of anointed adoption specific to the enthroned king, Psalm 2:7, the king was Yahweh's anointed, Messiah, descendant of Judah, Genesis 49:10, his ruling representative among all his earthly children, Psalm 2:2. As with Moses, the kingship by virtue of this adoptive language carried with it a quasi-divine aspect, Psalm 46, Psalm 45, 6 and 7. Psalm 89, 27 casts the throne of David as the Most High, Elyon, among all the nations. The ultimate son of David was presumed would be a prophet like unto Moses, Deuteronomy 18, 15, Acts 3, 22, and 7, 37. Not only were Adam, Moses, and Israel corporally God's servant, but King David was Yahweh's servant. Ibed Lima, 2 Samuel 3, 18, 7, 5, and 8, Psalm 89, 3. As were other godly kings, 1 Kings 3, 7, 2 Chronicles 32, 16. One particular branch or offshoot from the tribe of Judah and David's line would be the individual servant God would use to bring salvation to Israel. Isaiah 11, 1, 49, 5, and 49, 3. Jeremiah 23, 5, 33, 15. Zechariah 3, 8, and 6, 12. Like the corporate servant Israel, this individual servant would suffer and die. Isaiah 53, 1 through 9. But yet live to see his offspring. Isaiah 53, 10. A multitude made righteous by his service, Isaiah 53, 11, the picture of Messiah begins to appear. Adam, son of God, Israel, son of God, Moses, son of God, King, Messiah, son of God. Adam, ruler, king. Israel, highest among nations. Moses, ruler, king, over God's people. King Messiah, ruler king, representative, represents David and Israel, ruler over God's people and all nations. Adam, servant, Israel, servant, Moses, servant, King Messiah, servant, represents Israel, redeems Israel, the field servant. Adam suffers, Israel suffers, Moses suffers. King Messiah suffers effective sins of others, Israel and all nations. Adam, exile and death, ceases to exist on earth. Israel suffers, or Israel, exile and death. Moses, exile and death, ceases to exist on earth. King Messiah, exile and death, ceases to exist on earth. Adam lives on with God and through descendants, resurrection contingent. Israel lives on through Judah, resurrection contingent. Moses lives on with God, resurrection contingent. King Messiah, resurrected by the power and plan of God. All who are his from Israel and all nations will rise and rule with him. The identity and purpose of the Messiah are unknowable from a Bible verse, and even many Bible verses. The profile proceeds along conceptual trajectories that eventually merge into a portrait. And so, Jesus' question, Luke 24, 26, to the two men on the road to Emmaus makes eminent sense. Was it not necessary that the Christ suffer these things and enter into his glory? Yes, of course it was. It's just hard to see that unless you know what you're looking for. The messianic portrait can only be discerned by assembling 100 terms, phrases, metaphors, and symbols, which themselves take on meaning only when their pattern and convergences are detected. There are a few other pieces to show you. They deserve a chapter all their own.